It's Bill McLaughlin. Welcome back to Post Classical. And once again, we've started this segment with music I've never heard before. I suppose that's true for many of you listening in. Let's ask Joe, what was it?
That was the Fantasia Bettica, which Faya composed in 1919. I've come to this piece through Pedro's performances, and I'm mesmerized by it. Mm-hmm. For me, this is a deeper, more memorable piece than Amor Brujo or The Nights in the Gardens of Spain. It represents a quest for authenticity. Faya utilized flamenco as a means of developing a modernist nationalist language of the turn of the 20th century, and he was in search for authentic flamenco, which is an inexhaustible topic. And the quest took a very specific form, finally, in 1922, when he and his colleague Federico García Lorca held a flamenco competition in the city of Granada. And if we listen to what they had to say about this competition, it sheds light on what he's trying to do in the Fantasia Bettica. Here is Faya. The dignified, hieratic song of yesterday has degenerated into the ridiculous flamenquism of today. In this latter, the essential elements of Andalusian song, those which are its glory, its ancient nobility titles, are adulterated and modernized. The sober vocal modulation has become an artificial ornamenting, more characteristic of the worst moments of the Italian decadent period than of the primitive songs of the East, with which ours can be compared only when they are pure. And here's Lorca. Gentlemen, the musical soul of our people is in great danger. The artistic treasure of an entire race is passing into oblivion. Each day another leaf falls from the admirable tree of Andalusian lyrics. Old men carry off to the grave priceless treasures of past generations, and a gross, stupid avalanche of cheap music clouds the delicious folk atmosphere of all Spain. When the cantor sings, he is celebrating a solemn rite as he rouses ancient essences from their sleep, wraps them in his voice, and flings them into the wind. He has a deeply religious sense of song. Through these chanters, the race releases its pain and its true history. They are simple mediums, the lyrical crest of our people. They are strange but simple folk who sing hallucinated by a brilliant point trembling on the horizon. So they're upset about the adulteration of flamenco. They want to find a purer form. And this is by no means ubiquitous. You have also Miguel de Unamuno, the famous Spanish philosopher, disagreeing with them and saying that the gypsy is, quote, uninvited, without a homeland, history, literature, or great historical figures. For Unamuno, the gypsy falsifies Spanish identity. So we're in the midst of this debate. What is the essence of Spain? And as Faya moves into this debate, he develops a flamenco-based musical idiom that becomes harsher and more elemental. And the final product of that is the Fantasia Bettica, which we're about to hear.
You know, that reminds me a little bit of the debates that went on with Hungarian music, just to take one place where people were upset with what they called restaurant music.
That's right.
And most of the gypsy chardas, we know, the stuff that Franz Liszt fell in love with because he wasn't actually Hungarian by spirit. He was more German than Hungarian. So he comes back and makes Hungarian rhapsodies, pretty much on restaurant music, but brilliant. And so I'm trying to think about who in Spain in 1920 had Lorca and Faya so upset? Probably guys working in a restaurant or a club or a bar, right? That's pop music. I don't think that it's, I mean, any more than American pop music was a threat to Stephen Foster. I don't get the sense of umbrage, but that's maybe because I'm not Spanish.
It was a long process in the 19th century of the popularization of flamenco.
Right. So, but popularization means more people get it and get to hear it. I don't understand. The argument is like music for specialists or music for the whole populace. I mean, Lorca says, let the whole people sing their voices. Well, guess what? Sometimes we don't like the way they sing. Listen to pop music nowadays. Pretty ugly, some of it, right?
So, Pedro, what do you make of this notion of flamenco having been adulterated and requiring a more authentic or pure embodiment?
Okay. Well, I think that there is a difference here, something that we have to make clear to the American listener, because it's not, you know, this is in Spanish more. One thing is the flamenco, and another thing is the cante hondo, What he means by the popularization is that the cante hondo, which is a real gypsy song, you know, which is difficult to listen to sometimes.
Could you translate that first, cante hondo?
Cante hondo means deep, depth song, deep song.
I see.
Hondo. Mm. So it means a deep that comes from the soul.
Gotcha.
Okay, which is what we heard at the beginning. That is cante hondo. That is what is considered really flamenco.
Right.
Okay. Now, that is not a very popular format. Hmm. It is not. So what is the most popular flamenco where more guitars are introduced and dancers?
Dancing.
Dancing, particularly. Because originally flamenco was without the guitar. It was just the voice.
Hmm.
Then after that, they added percussion. There is one typical cante hondo song, which is called the martinete, which means that they would use the hammer that you use when you are working to accompany the cante hondo.
I see.
And after that became the stomping and the clapping and the guitars.
Right.
And at the very end, the dancing. Mm-hmm. Now, for most people here, particularly in America, when you talk about flamenco, people
think about
the dancing.
Of course.
So that's why I'm saying that when he's talking about the adulteration is that the original cante hondo, which was, you know, a very deep expression, it has transformed itself into something that is easier to sell. Mm-hmm. But that is the problem with everything in this world.
Anyway. So we can talk about cante hondo in relationship to the fantasy of Bética much more readily than if we were talking about the noches.
Yes.
Can you talk about the issue of authenticity and the quest for authenticity in the Bética?
In the Bética. Okay. The first thing that you have to keep in mind is the name that he gave to the piece, Fantasia Bética. Bética is the name of the Roman province that was in the south of Spain in the time of the Romans. And actually, he wrote the title of the piece in Latin, which is Baetica, B-A-E-T-I-C-A. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the title of the piece. Now, he's telling you, just by that he's really looking for the real roots of flamenco. I mean, we talked in the nights about the gypsies coming and getting something that was left by the Moors. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, here we are talking about, you know, hundreds of years before what it is that the Moors took. What was there? We are talking about times of the Romans, the Tartessians, the Carthaginians, all these people who were roaming about the Mediterranean.
Gauls there for a while.
Yeah. You know, and that is the real, he's going to, you know, look for the real roots of the flamenco. What was there? So it's a very bellicose piece. It's like warriors, very tribal, very primitive, you know, very violent. And in the middle of that, like the same way that in the nights you get the Spanish song, in the middle of that you have a section which is cante hondo.
So, Pedro, this is a very different piano style than what we've been listening to in the noches. Talk about that.
The theme of the Fantasia Bética is the same theme of the nights. Very similar. You were talking about the half tones. Okay.
Yeah, yep.
If you hear the way the piano is treated in the nights, very flexible sound, the water, the arabesque. Blah, 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 blah. In the Bética, it's the same thing, but it's much harsher. It's just the very beginning that we heard. And you can hear the theme. You hear the theme. It's funny. But it's the way it's treated. He's using the piano as a very percussive instrument.
Right.
As I said, he's trying to convey this idea of tribal and ancient and bellicose. And so that's the way you have to play this piece. And this piece is played a lot, actually more than I thought. Many people play this piece all over the world. Mm. And they don't have a clue, I'm sorry to say. They don't have a clue. And they play it very well, because it's a hard piece. And that's why people play it. You know, we pianists are so stupid that when somebody says that a piece is difficult, we all want to play it.
Mm-hmm.
That's very
so
typical.
We should talk about Rubinstein now.
Yeah.
But then, after all this wild stuff, all the rhythmic, the dance stuff, he stops the rhythm completely, just stopping his track. And then we have, this is a different kind of song.
Yes.
What is that?
That's the real cante hondo.
Just imagine, folks, we have about 2 or 3 minutes of wild stuff going on, rhythmic stuff, dance stuff, and now all of a sudden, this. So it's almost as if in the midst of this crowd scene, a solo performer, dancer, singer, comes and takes center stage, stops the action.
Yeah, yeah, that is very common in Spain also. In the Holy Week, people do that when you have all these religious processions, somebody who comes out and sings to the Virgin or to whatever, you know. So the important thing here, if I may say it, you know, which is the fact that what really obsessed Falla about the Cante Hondo is the fact that they don't follow the half-step thing that we all follow, right?
Right, right.
They get in between the half and the quarter tones. This is what really he said was the main characteristic of Cante Hondo. Mm-hmm. And he tries to implement that in the piano. And of course, you cannot do that in the piano because, you know...
You can play F-sharp or G, but you can't play something halfway in between.
Correct. So what he does is that he mixes notes that are close by, F-sharp, F-natural, G, and you play them arpeggiato in a way that the listener doesn't really know where it is, but eventually you get to the note.
Uh-huh.
And that can be heard very well in what we just heard right now. Is that pain that you were talking about before.
How does this come out at the end? What's the ending, like a fantasia?
The Betica? Fantasia Betica, you mean the end of the piece?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a great ending. The piece ends with a coda, which is very effective.
Brilliant.
Very brilliant, but hold on a second. People tend to play it too fast.
Uh-huh.
And Falla says, when you get to the coda, says in tempo, which is usually, you know, in music you get a tempo. But in tempo means don't rush.
Right.
Because if you rush, you lose all the strength. And everybody rushes that end.
It's like Scott Joplin said, you must never play ragtime too fast.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's the same thing. It's the same. So it's a very powerful ending, but as long as you hold the tempo under control.
Can't wait to hear this. Once again, Pedro Carbone, piece for solo piano, the Fantasia Bettica, music of De Falla. I'm going to add my applause to that performance.
Thank
Bravo,
you.
Pedro.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Fantasia Bettica from an early province. That's a Roman name. Music of Defia. I got to ask one question since I have two genuine Spaniards in the studio. I've been lectured both ways. People say, don't say Defia, just say Fia. What do you guys think? Is it okay either way?
It's okay either way.
Yes. That's what I thought.
I think Spanish in general,
we say fire. We say fire.
Okay.
And Americans tend to say defia.
I know. And radio announcers beat each other up. They get into fist fight over this issue. Yeah. So I'm going to say, say it how you like it. Yeah. You know, that's always good advice.
In Spain, we always say fire.
Fire, simple. Okay, good to know. I'll follow that then. So this wonderful work of Fire owes its conception to a great Polish pianist who's renowned for his performance of the great romantic repertoire, Chopin, Brahms, Beethoven, Arthur Rubinstein. Joe, how did that happen?
Rubinstein liked to play the ritual fire dance from Amor Brujo. He was famous for playing it with his hands flying in the air.
Yeah.
So all of this I know from Pedro. So he commissioned a piece for himself, and it turned out to be the Fantasia. Okay, much better.
Not exactly.
Ask Pedro about Rubinstein. I shouldn't be answering this question, but it's an important question, and it's an important answer.
Okay.
Rubinstein started his concertizing career in Spain. Not everybody knows that.
I did not know that.
See? So he says that in his memoirs. So he had lots of contacts in Spain, knew many people. His main manager was in Madrid, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so he liked to play as an encore the fire dance.
From
Amor Brujo, okay?
Right.
Which is a piece, of course, you know, it's conceived for an orchestra, and the transcription is by Falla, but the transcription in the piano doesn't work, in my opinion, because it's conceived for the colors of the orchestra. So once you remove all those colors, or you have, you know, fewer colors in the piano, once you remove those colors, in order to add interest, you have to add some tempo. You have to play it a little faster. And then all that intimate ambience of fire dance is gone. Mm-hmm. Okay, but anyway, Rubinstein didn't care about any of this. He played the piece. He played it as an encore. And, you know, he liked always to show off. He liked to show off a lot. Okay,
he's a virtuoso.
Yeah,
he
was a virtuoso. So then he plays the fire dance. And there is a bar. You can find this in YouTube. I mean, this performance of the fire dance by fire, right? He moves his hands up and down. Pop, 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 pop.
He's showing the hands coming about 2.5 feet off the keyboard.
Yeah, he does. He loves doing that. And he says that also in his memoirs. Like, he loved to do that. And people would get very impressed. Oh, what a great pianist. Okay. Now, that has nothing to do with the reality of the fire dance. That's the truth. So the story says that Falla was in one of those concerts, and he heard the fire dance. Of course, we don't know what he thought, but I have an idea what he thought. So he went to Rubinstein, and he said, you want to play a virtuoso piano piece, you know, a Spanish piano piece? I'll compose one for you. And then he composed the Fantasia Bettica. So he gave it to, as in the dedicatory, it's dedicated to Rubinstein. He gave it to him. He learned the piece. He played it once, and he never played it again.
It's funny because he did the same thing with Stravinsky in the set from Petrushka. He commissioned, and he didn't play those either.
Why? Because he wanted a showpiece.
Right. Yeah.
And the Bettica is not a showpiece. It's not a showpiece.
For one thing, 14 and a half minutes, that's a long encore.
I know. Of course, the idea was to play it not as an encore, but as part of the program. But it's a piece that is a lot of work. It's hard to play. It's difficult to play. And you don't get many results because it's not flashy. And as I said, most of us pianists are shallow people who want to show off in front of other people the things that we can do with the keyboard. Okay? So when there is a difficult piece, we all want to play it better than anybody else and faster than anybody else. Okay?
And we want everyone to know how difficult it is.
Yes. We want them to know. And sometimes pieces which are not played very often, once people realize that they are difficult, then they want to play it. That happened with Iberia. You know, 30 years ago, not many people played Iberia. And now everybody plays it. Why? Because it began to spread that it's difficult to play. It's the same thing with Rachmaninoff third, Brahms second. It's the same thing, you know. And it's not a question of playing them faster and louder. And this is the problem with the Bettica, okay? Mm-hmm. So in the Bettica, you have to keep in mind the essence of the music, the colors, the rhythms, and the ugliness of the sound. The sound has to be ugly. It's a primitive piece. It takes us to remote times. And pianists don't like that. And they tend to play it always too fast and, as I said, too beautiful. They try to make beautiful. When we were listening to the Cantejondo at first, to the Gypsy, you said, you know, but it sounds like pain. Yes, it sounds like pain. It doesn't sound beautiful, but it is very moving. It's the same thing with the Bettica.
I'm echoing. I'm remembering Heinz Holliger, the great Swiss oboist. He was looking at me as a conductor. He said, Bill, you Americans are such tone junkies. You want everything to be so sweet and so beautiful. It's not all beautiful.
I agree with that. Yeah. I agree with that, yeah.
Okay, so then we have Falla and Lorca. They have this competition to find the true flamenco. Right. Was it a big success? What happened?
What happened is a very strange story. Falla never again based a piece of music on the flamenco idiom. He dropped it.
The problem with the flamenco competition is that gypsies in Spain in the 1920s, they were considered very low class. Okay, nobody would think that anything cultural would come out of them. Okay, so when Falla said, let's do a competition, you know, with cantejondo, which is something that gypsies do, nobody took it seriously.
I see.
And they made fun of him. He says that in his memoir, Falla, you know. He said that many of his good friends in Madrid, you know, that they turned back on him when he was defending gypsies and defending cantejondo and defending flamenco because they thought that it was worthless.
Lorca, in his work, goes on until his death in the middle of the Spanish Civil War, did seem to follow this dream, at least. He's not a composer, but he's sort of a flamenco playwright in a way.
Yeah. I'm not talking about Lorca. I'm talking about the mediocrities who ran the world.
I see.
Okay? So the ones who ran the world at that point in Madrid, they decided that... You know, so he was so upset, Falla, because of the people who failed him, that he decided that he didn't want to have anything to do with flamenco.
So he turns his back on...
Anymore, yes. And the last piece that he composed under the flamenco umbrella was the Bettica. So that's why the Bettica is so important, because it really closes a whole period of his life.
So now here we are. Here's Falla in the 1920s, and Papa needs a brand new bag. He's got to get something done. He's been disappointed by the reaction, the people not coming forward with this admiration and love of flamenco the way he had. And now he stops writing flamenco.
Right.
Where's he go next?
We're going next to the concerto, which is for keyboard, either piano or harpsichord, and six instruments. This is composed from 1923 to 1926. It's 15 minutes long. We're at a point where Falla's production drops. It takes him a long time to write a piece, and then he's more or less silent and expires in Argentina. I think he belongs to a group of composers who struggle to adapt to modernism and to the influence of people like Stravinsky. He essentially stopped composing. You could compare him to Sibelius, Elgar, and Ives, the other three composers who fit that description. But he doesn't stop altogether, and the concerto is another piece, like the Bettica, that I've come to through Pedro. I find it a piece that's just inexhaustibly interesting. It's very pertinent, in my opinion, that Stravinsky composed Le Noce in 1923 and his piano concerto in 1924. Mm-hmm. I think these pieces threw a curve, and Falla was trying to adapt. And you'll hear, especially in the first mood of the concerto, a kind of cubistic style from Falla, which is new to him, but which comes right out of Stravinsky. Here's a description from 1927 from the Spanish critic Adolfo Salazar. It is recognized that there is no better exercise to purify an idiom based in national or folkloric formulas of expression than its repeated practice under a principle of intensification that forces constant evolution. This, as it seems to me to have been the case with Stravinsky, has certainly been true with Falla. Accordingly, Falla purified the elements of his style work after work, his language becoming more concentrated in expression. And so this amazing concentration of expression takes an extreme form in the three movements of the concerto, and each of them is a different picture of Spain. I know that from Pedro. Pedro says that the three movements encapsulate the whole of Spanish music minus flamenco. Can we start just with the second movement, Pedro? Mm-hmm. What is going on in the second movement of the concerto?
Well, in the concerto, he takes what he considers the three pillars of Spanish music. Okay? And the second movement represents a religious music, which in Spain is together with culture. I mean, religion and culture, they are so mixed together. Okay, so the second movement is like a very solemn procession inside the church. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's funny because he conveys that solemnity with five instruments and the piano. It's like if you want to convey that, you would use a big choir and mix it for an orchestra.
So this is...
It's this idea of the austerity. He was very austere in his life. I mean, his bedroom had like a chair and a bed, and that was it. I mean, he was like that. So is this austerity there. The theme that he's using is taken from the Mozarab ritual of the church in the 15th or 14th century. I don't know, I'm not a historian, but anyway. These are the people who were Moorish and converted to Christianity, to Christians when the Moors left Spain, okay? This is a song that is taking three notes from that particular song. And on those three notes, he builds the whole movement. And there are many things that you can hear, like, for instance, all this Catholic thing that they like. Of course, Catholic tradition in Spain, you don't have that in here, so it's hard for me to explain, but they love all these priests, to make all these very ceremonial things. Well, you can see that, with the Catholic Church, with the Pope and all that, and they have all these chains and all these things and this incense and all that. He tries to put that in the music.
So he's putting this back, say, in 16th century Spain, something about that, or maybe a little bit earlier.
Yeah. And it's so powerful, the second movement, that Ravel considered that, the masterpiece of chamber music in the 20th century.
Really?
I don't know if I would go so far, but he did. Ravel did. And that's the main thing about the second movement. And there is also one thing. Before playing it, Falla, he would kneel. He would kneel down and make the cross sign before playing that movement.
He's playing with this chamber music, so he would walk on stage with the chamber ensemble and kneel down.
No, I don't think he did it in public.
I see.
He did it at home. Okay. And also one thing about this concerto that you have to know is that he conceived this concerto for the harpsichord.
Uh-huh.
Originally for the harpsichord, because the harpsichord has the sound that he's looking for. Mm-hmm. But eventually there are so many things written in the concerto that need a piano. You have accents and crescendos and many things, that eventually he said for harpsichord or piano. And when he premiered the piece in Paris, I met somebody who was there, actually, a Spanish composer who died a few years ago, Joaquin Inculmel. He told me that in the first movement, he played it with a harpsichord in the first half. And in the second half, he played it with a piano. So he played twice the piece with both instruments. And I always said that the best instrument for this would be an electronic keyboard. That sounds like a harpsichord where you can control the sound and make accents and things like that. That would be the best instrument, but I'll never play it there because I wouldn't be able to. Anyway, so that's the second movement.
So it's an austere religious epiphany.
Let's start in by listening to the second movement. This is the Falla Concerto, and once again, our soloist Pedro Carbonell.
Thank you.
to admit, that piece is really hard for me to understand. This is my first hearing of it. I hear about seven different directions. I hear sort of Lutheran chorale tunes and little da-da-dee-da. Sounds like the opening of the last movement of Mozart, Jupiter. He has this cantus firmus idea. This is where you take an old hymn tune. That's what you're saying. It's coming from an old Spanish tune. Mm-hmm. But then some of the stuff with the arpeggios and the scales could almost have been written by someone like Saint-Saëns. It's like a music so mellifluous, side by side with this really cold, acerbic, modern stuff. What's he doing? It's confusing to me.
When I first heard this piece, it made no sense to me. Mm. When I heard it again, it still made no sense to me. And having lived with this piece with these two guys, Post-Classical Ensemble developed a strategy for presenting it by contextualizing each movement separately. So to contextualize this movement,
right. We
turn to Tomás Luis de Victoria, and I'll let Ángel explain why.
But before we talk about Victoria, I would like to bring to the attention to our audience a very important name for Manuel de Falla, who was his mentor and teacher, Felipe Pedrel, who was also mentor and teacher of, as you know, Granados and Albéniz. And he said something very important to them that they took very seriously. The inspiration for a composer comes, on the one hand, from the vernacular, the popular vernacular,
right. But
on the other hand, from the tradition.
Right.
So in this time, Falla is going back to the Golden Age and going back to the great tradition in music in Spain, Tomás Luis de Victoria.
So the 16th century, you said.
The 16th century. And then later, and Pedro will explain us that later, is the school of the keyboard of the 18th century.
Uh-huh.
So this is the story of this concerto.
Trying to think, is that Padre Scolaire? Who's around in the 18th
century? Exactly. Padre Soler.
Soler, Scarlatti. Scarlatti was in Madrid.
Scarlatti.
Oh, even if he's an Italian composer, he was living his life in Spain, of course.
So we are going back to the Golden Age. Uh-huh. And this instrument tried to sound like old instruments. Before Harnoncourt and before Gustav Leonhardt, Falla was trying to imitate the sound of the medieval instruments.
I got it.
This is what is here. Uh-huh. This is all these harsh sounds that he's trying to produce. He's trying to imitate this ancient, the ancestors of the oboe, the clarinet, and the flute, etc. Huh. So I think that's very important. Why Victoria? Again, the word that I think is the magic word to understand the Spanish music, austerity.
Uh-huh.
If anybody has written with the minimum number of pitches, the most beautiful music is Tomás Luis de Victoria. It's the perfection of the sound. With the minimum, we go to the real excels. And Victoria is, of course, part of this, very, very important part of this movement.
So Ángel will typically do a set of motets on the same program, Victoria motets, that we do the concerto, and we can hear one of them. Do you want to set that up for us, Angel?
Yes. So the motet that I chose is Caligaverunt Oculi Mei, which is My Eyes Are Darkened by My Tears. It's one of the most dramatic. I don't think anybody has written anything as dramatic as this until Bach wrote the Crucifixus of the B minor mass. It's the saddest, it's the impression of somebody who is looking at Jesus Christ in the cross.
Yeah, so it's the time of the Passion. Okay, so here is Falla with that in his mind. Let's listen to this performance now. This is music of Tomás
Luis de Victoria. Caligaverunt Oculi Mei.
Thank you.
whenever I hear music of the 16th century, I usually wind up thinking, you know, music never really got any better than it was right then.
Totally agree.
I know. I mean,
the best Spanish composer is Tomás de Victoria.
Yeah, but meanwhile, in Italy, you got Monteverdi coming out of that, and the Gabrielis. In England, you had the great composers of the Tudor. 16th century has its moments, and obviously, Faya felt the same way, and he drew the inspiration for the second movement of his piano concerto from this music of Victoria. What did he do for the first movement, Joe?
He takes a popular Spanish song and breaks it up, obviously under the influence of Stravinsky. I'll let Pedro describe this movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, each movement in his concerto presents a major component of Spanish music. So the second movement, we said, is the religious music. This one is the popular music.
Uh-huh.
It's the popular medieval music. So as we said, Falla moved away from Andalusian folklore. So this is all based in Castilian folklore. So he takes this Castilian medieval song and he treats it in this cubistic manner. You can recognize it right away. You know? But of course, that's what you said. I mean, when you first hear this concerto, you miss all these things, even if you are a musician, you know, because you don't know any of these. So that's why it's a very difficult piece to program, because, you know, requires some knowledge from the public.
So there's a very popular version of this popular song.
Yes.
And we, post-classical ensemble, typically interpolate a live performance of the most popular version of this popular song, which is that of Joaquin Rodrigo, and the song is De los Alamos Vengo Madre.
Let's listen to it a bit.
Was Victoria de Los Angeles singing De Los Alamos Vengo Madre in the version by Joaquin Rodrigo.
Mm-hmm.
And very quickly, let's hear how this tune is fractured by De Falla about 1 minute into the first movement of his concerto. This is the first recording, and the harpsichordist is the composer.
Thank you.
I think that might be as much Picasso as it is Stravinsky. The
yes,
right.
It's
kind of a cubist approach.
I always said that myself, yes. Very Picassian.
So now we can talk, if you wish, about the use of the harpsichord. I will say, in my experience, mm-hmm. when this piece is played with a harpsichord, you cannot hear the harpsichord.
It's a problem with harpsichords, unless you over-mic them, in which case they sound like, you know, Phantom
and this
of the
is,
Opera.
This is very over-mic. This is original recording. It very much slights the other five instruments mm-hmm. in order to make the harpsichord audible. So, Pedro, is there anything else you'd like to say about the first movement before we hear the whole thing?
As a performer, as a pianist, when you have to play this piece, you have to keep in mind exactly what we said, that it was conceived for the harpsichord, but you play it in a piano in order to make many of the nuances there that are impossible to do with the harpsichord. So, which means that when you sit down on the piano to play this, you have to make it sound a little bit like a harpsichord. Exactly. So you have to avoid unnecessary crescendos or
a lot of pedal or that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and also the touch mm-hmm. of the piano and the amount of pedal that you use. You have to get that idea of a harpsichord. You know, and the main thing with this movement is that there are two themes. The first one, which mm-hmm. is by Falla, ti ta 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 ta, and de Los Alamos Vengo. If you are able to identify, you know, both themes when they come out, you are already almost there with this. Listening to this piece.
Get an A and if you don't know that, you are nowhere.
You are nowhere, you don't have a clue. You don't have a clue. You listen to this and you say, what the hell was that?
Oh, come on, folks. People have been hanging with us for over an hour and a half. I bet they can make it. Okay, folks, we're going to listen to the first movement of the concerto for piano, in this case. And once again, our pianist is Pedro Carbonet. Thank you. We just heard the first movement now of Falla's Concerto for Piano. This is Pedro Carbonet playing for us today. And Pedro, what about the third movement? What is this concerto? Yet another style.
Yes, another completely different thing. He takes what he considers the other peak of Spanish music, which was the keyboard school of the 18th century. You know, there was Scarlatti, the Italian composer. He came and stayed at Escorial for several years, and he created a composition school. And there are several Spanish composers. The best known is Padre Soler. He composed many, many sonatas in the Scarlatti style. And that is probably the peak of, I would say, of modern or more sophisticated Spanish music after the, the Tomás Luis de Victoria and all that. He makes that the point. Falla hated zarzuela. You know what zarzuela is?
Sort of a
operetta, which is what people listened to in Spain in the 19th century. Yeah. Most popular thing.
And
was,
Domingo still goes around the world singing zarzuela. Yes, zarzuela. Still very popular.
Okay. So Falla hated zarzuela, which was the predominant thing in 19th century Spain. Mm-hmm. So when he tries to put all the history of Spanish music in one piece, which is what he does here, right? He goes to the popular music of the Renaissance in the first movement. In the second movement, he goes to the polyphonic school. And then in the third movement, goes to the keyboard school of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. So he skips the 19th century on purpose because zarzuela is there. And he presents all these three different in a language of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So we have all the centuries except for the 19th century. Yeah. Right. Okay. So he's taking his inspiration for this movement in the sonatas of Padre Soler. And actually, there is one theme in the third movement that you can see clearly that is taken from a famous Soler sonata. Uh-huh. And so he's doing this harpsichord, virtuosistic playing. Well, you have to listen to it.
Okay, so very rapid passage work is what you're showing me with your hands. You folks that can't see the display here, it's really a pity.
Yeah, well, he's recreating the 18th century school of composition in Escorial, Scarlatti. So he's showing us, as I said, the three peaks of Spanish music.
So, Bill, as you might have inferred, since we're contextualizing this piece in performance, Pedro predictably plays us a Soler sonata in order to get us acclimated for the third movement of the concerto. So here's Pedro playing Soler.
Thank you.
music of Padre Soler, sonata for piano, harpsichord, I guess, originally, but anyway, played here by Pedro Carbonet at the piano. Now let's dive into the third movement, the final movement of Falla's piano concerto. Back home to the tonic. That's the finale of Falla's piano concerto, played brilliantly by Pedro Carbonet. That was Angel Gil Ordóñez conducting a post-classical ensemble on that performance. And you know what? I love working for this station. We're working for the Classical Network. And you know what? They can just do as they please. So they gave us another hour because we got more stuff. So hang with us, folks. We've got yet a third hour of post-classical. Don't go anywhere. We got some really great stuff. Albanith, for one thing. So hang with us. We'll be right back.